All right, grab your Bibles. Let's get back into this study. And you can turn with me to Matthew chapter 7. It's hard to believe we're kind of in the last little bit here, last chapter of the Sermon on the Mount. Haven't decided what we'll do after this. I'm open to requests or whatever. if you've always wanted to study a particular book, or just shoot me an email and we'll consider it. No guarantees though, but still going to decide. I was thinking maybe something, possibly something in the Old Testament. But Matthew chapter 7, and we've got one chapter left on the Sermon on the Mount. And not only is chapter 7, though, the last chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, if I can find my pocket here, it also begins for us. We're jumping into the last real major section of the body of the sermon before Jesus begins to get into some concluding remarks and exhortations. Really, from verse 13 onward down to the end of chapter 7 is all considered conclusion stuff. And so if you were to just kind of look at the structure of the sermon as a whole, it began with an introduction in chapter 5, and the body of the sermon didn't really start until, I would say, chapter 5, verse 17 or so. And so this is the last really main section in what's officially the body of the sermon. And so verses 1 through 12 really deals primarily with the true disciples' approach to earthly relationships, ministry relationships. So that's what we're going to be talking about for the next few weeks. It contains a lot of well-known stuff. Perhaps you've heard before, maybe haven't read in context, but it starts, like we're going to study this morning, it starts with the passage probably most quoted by unbelievers in verse 1 about judging or not judging, rather. It ends with verse 12, what we would know as the golden rule. So lots of familiar stuff in this section. And the issue in these 12 verses, in this last section of the Sermon on the Mount, is all about how we should conduct ourselves in our earthly relationships as heavenly citizens. That's really what Jesus begins to now focus on before he closes his sermon. And we're only going to have time, like I said, to cover the first 5 verses this morning. Might even end a little bit earlier. But just as it's been our habit every time we start a new section, let's go ahead and read. Let's read the whole section, not just the first 5 verses. Let's read verses 1 through 12, and then we'll come back and then cover the first 5 verses in more detail. Look at what Jesus says. Matthew 7, verse 1. Do not judge so that you will not be judged, for in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, another familiar phrase perhaps to you, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? In everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets." So maybe you remember, but from just a quick review of the context and where we are up until this point, from chapter 5 into chapter 6, Jesus, you remember, moves from addressing the wrong interpretation of God's standard of righteousness to now, in chapter 6, what we've been looking at and what we finished last time, addressing the wrong practice of God's standard of righteousness. You remember the very first part of the Sermon on the Mount, the body of the sermon, Jesus corrected the misinterpretation of God's law, a misunderstanding of where God actually put the standard. And by the time you get into chapter 6, he says, not only is your righteousness to surpass the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious leaders at the time, in how you understand the scriptures, but also in how you practice God's standard. And really, that's what we've been discussing. And it's this discussion about our practice of righteousness that is pulled into chapter 7 and continues into chapter 7. It's been the subject since chapter 6, verse 1. It's the subject of chapter 7 as well, just broadly speaking. And concerning the practical outworking of our righteousness, it also must surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And you remember the beginning of chapter 6, the first 18 verses, maybe Jesus, in focusing on our practice of righteousness, dealt with how we are to approach our personal spiritual disciplines and religious activities like giving, praying, fasting. You remember, he says, your righteousness, even in the performance of those spiritual disciplines and religious activities, must surpass the scribes and the Pharisees. In what way? You remember? In what way is our practice of those things to surpass the hypocrites and the religious leaders? Remember? I know this is reaching back some. Come on. Our motivation, exactly. Remember, it's in those things in the first part of chapter 6, he says, why do they do it? Why do they give? Why do they pray? And why do they fast? Be seen by men. Yeah, that's their motive. And so Jesus says, your motive should be different, and that's how you surpass their practice. And in fact, their motive, it taints their practice, doesn't it? It causes them to perform those things only when people are watching. And Jesus says, actually, if you want to do this for my glory and my glory alone, you should do it when the true test is when nobody sees, only your Heavenly Father. And so moving from that first part, still talking about our practice, the outworking of our righteousness, the second half of chapter 6, which we finished last time, ran from verses 19 through 34, and he deals with there then how we are to view and use our earthly resources and material possessions. Not only are we to pray and give and fast and do whatever religious activities and spiritual disciplines for God's glory, Jesus goes on and he makes the bridge and says, you are also to use the physical things that God blesses you with in this life, your material resources, for his glory as well. And that's the connection. And so in the second half of chapter 6, still speaking of the practice of our righteousness, he says, that must surpass the scribes and the Pharisees also, because they live for this. They actually imagine that money is the end of life. They even perform their religious activities for the sake of personal gain. And Jesus says in the second half of chapter 6, our relationship to things, material things and resources, is to be different. And So by the time you get to chapter 7, where we are, the first 12 verses here, Jesus turns now and he begins, he's still talking about the practice and the outworking of our righteousness, but he begins now to talk about it from the angle of relationships. He begins to look at how does the practice of our righteousness then in this life, what does that look like when it comes to our relationships? He's dealt with spiritual disciplines, he's dealt with material things, and now he moves on to relationships. You could say, to summarize the flow of the sermon overall in this way, you could say that beginning with chapter 6, concerning the practice of our righteousness, Jesus has moved from discussing our practice in private, the first 18 verses of chapter 6, to talk about our practice with possessions, second part of chapter 6, and now he turns to talk about our practice towards people. And we've been challenged, you could say, about our personal relationship with the Lord, about our relationship to things, and now he's going to challenge us about our relationship towards others. And you will find that the thread throughout all of these sections, including chapter 7 now, in every one of these arenas, Jesus is going to put and has put his finger on the idolatry that tempts us. Jesus, in every single one of these areas, has exposed our tendency as we live on this earth to exalt ourselves rather than to give glory to God. And this is true even of his disciples. In fact, we read it earlier. You notice that even in our section, verse 10, he assumes that verse 11, we being evil, we are evil, we have this that plagues us. It is our indwelling sin. And so he has to encourage us, challenge us in our practice of righteousness as we live out this life on this earth, in this fallen world, and with the sin that hangs on so tightly. We've seen the temptation to use giving, praying, and fasting for our own significance. We've seen the temptation to use material wealth and earthly possessions for our own comforts. And in this final section, Jesus sets out to warn against the temptation, listen guys, to use relationships with other people for our own glory as well. You might have sat through the rest and said, hey, I don't have any problem with, you know, material things, materialism. I don't tend to use those things for my own glory, but it may be that it's in this area, in relationships, where you struggle. And so this is so helpful for us. And the question here that Jesus begins to take up is, how can we rather use our earthly relationships for a heavenly purpose? I mean, what is it that God has left you here for? We've already talked about this to some degree. Early on in chapter 5, we are to be salt, we are to be light. Our relationship, God does not just beam us out of this world once he saves us. We still have relationships with people, with sinners, being sinners ourselves, and yet we belong to a different kingdom. And Jesus now begins to walk us through, what does that then look like? What are the challenges that present themselves to us? This is so relevant. What does it look like for Jesus' followers to surpass the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees in their relationships to others, in their ministry? How can we as Christians fulfill the law and the prophets as we relate to people and seek to minister to them in our time here on earth? I hope you've asked that question before. We find out exactly how in this final section on the Sermon on the Mount, a section that ends with this fitting summary statement of verse 12, a familiar one known as the Golden Rule. Just I'll read it to you. In everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets. Notice, I mean, we'll get there and we'll talk about it more specifically in due time, but whatever we determine about this final section in the next couple of weeks, including this morning, we can be sure from this summary conclusion in verse 12 that we're going to be learning about how we should treat other people, and we can also be sure that how we end up treating other people is ultimately an issue of fulfilling the law and the prophets. That's what Jesus has been discussing this entire sermon. And it's no wonder he ends up here in our relationships. Should be no surprise to us, because after all, the whole law, you perhaps remember from other places, can be summed up in two statements. That is, love God and love your neighbor. And so chapter 6, again, you could put it this way then, just another way to categorize these things. Chapter 6 has primarily been about loving God. In your giving, your praying, your fasting, in your relationship with money and material resources. But now in chapter 7, Jesus will speak about loving our neighbor. What does that look like as someone who belongs to a different kingdom? And that's how this section fits into the grand scheme of the Sermon on the Mount. You know me, I love to fit things into their context. But I think that's helpful. I think that's even helpful as we begin to unpack these specific first five verses, because as you'll see, they're much misunderstood. They're very much misunderstood. And we need to understand what Jesus is doing here and how he gets here. He's been expositing all that it means to fulfill the law and the prophets, to practice a standard of righteousness that was given to us by God as his true children. That's the big picture. But let me zoom in a bit now to the first five verses and just really quickly show you how even specifically Jesus connects to what he begins to talk about in chapter 7. All along the way, in expositing what the true standard of righteousness is, Jesus, you remember, he's been not just expositing what the true standard is, he's been also exposing the false standard of righteousness that the religious hypocrites practiced. And this hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees always seemed to end up with a false sense of human righteousness that was more self-righteousness than it was God's true standard of heart righteousness. And so I want you to notice something here in our passage this morning. Just like Jesus nails the issue, you remember in the previous section in verse 30, you remember I said last week that little phrase there, you of little faith, that's actually one word. It's an exclamation, and with it, he just nails the real issue in that paragraph. It was a lack of faith. The real issue behind their worrying, he exposes with this one word. Notice he does the same kind of thing in our passage. Look at verse 5. It's the same kind of thing. But it shows up at the front, and he says here, you hypocrite. And it's also one word in the original text. This time, the one word exclamation that gets straight at the real issue here is not you of little faith, but rather it is you hypocrite. And think about this. Once again, Jesus is condemning religious hypocrisy here. He is picking that theme up again. He's never left it, really. And with this, he brings back all the warnings that we saw and even rehearsed in chapter 6. Chapter 6, he uses this term, verse 2, verse 5, verse 16. He calls out the hypocrisy of the religious leaders in their practice of righteousness, where we're told that they gave, they prayed, they fasted primarily to be seen and praised by men for their own significance and glory. Jesus says that's hypocrisy. But you get here and you realize this is also hypocrisy. Just like it was hypocrisy in chapter 6 to perform those outward acts of righteousness for such selfish reasons, you get to chapter 7 and verses 1 through 5, Jesus says it is just as hypocritical to assume, and here's the issue, that we can help others with their sin while at the same time ignoring our own. That's what Jesus begins to talk about here. Why is this hypocrisy? Well, because, think about this for a moment, the internal motive behind the external act in both cases is selfish. I mean, we are play acting and performing as though we love God by, in chapter 6, by making a display of our giving, making a display of our praying and our fasting. We're play acting and performing as though we love others here by seeking to help them with their sins. But the whole time, the whole while doing all of this, we're doing it for our own significance, to make ourselves feel better, to make ourselves look better in the eyes of men. None of it is truly genuine. That is the issue. That is why it's hypocrisy here. You know, John Broadus writes this. He says, as it is hypocrisy in chapter 6 to make a display of righteousness, so it is hypocrisy here to assume the right to judge others and correct their faults. Especially, guys, when there are greater sins in our own lives that we turn a blind eye to. And here is the problem, isn't it? I mean, just like in chapter 6, when we can use even ministry to puff ourselves up. I mean, that's just, sometimes it is shocking sometimes to see how wicked our hearts can be. And yet Jesus knows this, and so he warns against it. We can puff ourselves up by parading our spiritual disciplines in public, and we could just as easily here puff ourselves up by pointing out the sins of others in self-righteousness. And Jesus condemns both. And this is what Jesus is getting after in our passage this morning. So let's look at it more closely now. Let's read the first five verses just again, and then we'll try and break it down and explain what's going on here. Jesus says now in this first section, do not judge that you will not be judged, for in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold that there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Now, notice first the prohibition. Look at verse 1. Notice first the prohibition. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. Now, as I said earlier, this is perhaps one of the most quoted verses, even on the lips of unbelievers. Anytime sin is pointed out, right? You might not know, people may not know any other verse in the Bible, but they know this one. Do not judge, lest you be judged, right? And right away, we are kind of faced with a problem. And part of the problem here, and the reason I think why this verse is so misquoted and misapplied, is because in the original text, I mean, even much like the English translation, the verb translated here to judge can be taken several different ways. Even in the original Greek, this word could mean anything from the act of simply making a selection or coming to a conclusion, or it could mean deciding something in an official court of law by a judicial process, or it could mean passing an unfavorable judgment upon, criticizing, fault-finding, and condemning someone or something. I think it's this last one that Jesus means here, but that's part of the problem, right? people don't define it that way. We need to decide what this means based on our context here, which we've already sort of reviewed, but let me just walk through each of these options. I think the easiest one to debunk is we can easily rule out the interpretation that Jesus is here speaking of some kind of official judicial system and process, as if we're not to have a court of law, as if Jesus is condemning any kind of judicial system. That's just not in the context. The context of this passage is not the courtroom. It's not a discussion about civil government and its practices of keeping criminals accountable for their actions. In fact, we made that point earlier on in chapter 5, verses 38 through 42. You know that passage about eye for eye, tooth for tooth, lex talionis, that principle. Jesus corrects the Pharisees because the Pharisees were using that in their own personal relationships. And Jesus says, you can't do that. So that's not the temptation. It's not a temptation for us perhaps to read Jesus saying, don't judge, and so all the judges, the Supreme Court judges, should be out of a job, you know. It's not what Jesus is saying here. But I think that perhaps the most misunderstood way this is taken is that we imagine that Jesus is, some people imagine that Jesus is prohibiting all kinds of, any kind of moral judgment that's made and condemning that. But that can't be the case here. Jesus can't be speaking here of simply, he's not prohibiting making a decision or coming to a conclusion about something or someone. He can't possibly be prohibiting his disciples from making any kind of moral judgment at all, or calling sin what it is, or discerning between right and wrong, because of the following. For one, the context of the Sermon on the Mount tells us, Jesus himself tells his disciples to exercise discernment and to point out sin. Notice even in our passage itself that the solution that we'll cover here that comes in verse 5, the solution to what Jesus is condemning here is not to refrain from judgment altogether, but what is it? Jesus tells us that we must first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. So the goal is still to see clearly, to discern the sin of another so that you can help him with it. I mean, that's not the issue. Not only that, look at the very next verse in verse 6. Jesus tells his disciples, do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine. Without even explaining precisely the meaning of this metaphor, we'll cover that next time. It's at least clear here that in order to obey this command, some kind of judgment must be made about what is holy and precious, and you have to be willing to call some people dogs and swine. Furthermore, when you broaden this to the rest of what Jesus taught his disciples, even later into the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 18, verses 15 through 20, a passage about church discipline, we're explicitly given a process, the church is, for Christians are, for judging and dealing with sin in and among God's people in a gracious way. A gracious but thorough way. So this can't mean what some people try to make it mean, that this is a blanket prohibition against calling out the sin of others, as if that... as if it's never okay to confront somebody on their sin, about their sin. That's not what Jesus is condemning here. No, rather, the issue is that of self-righteously condemning someone without consideration first for yourself and your own soul and your own sins. That's what Jesus is actually condemning here. Just notice the language that follows. Notice first the following reasons given for not judging in this way immediately point us back to examine our own conduct. You notice that? Jesus says, look at verse 1. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. Verse 2, for in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Right away, Jesus points us back and takes the magnifying glass, and instead of pointing it at the other person, points it back to us. And immediately, it is a call back to examine our own conduct. The obvious reminder here, and thus the deterrent to self-righteousness in our judgment of others, is that this. Listen, guys, we are all accountable to the same standard and to the same God. Jesus is reminding us here of that. Jesus tells us right up front that the knowledge that we ourselves are not exempt from God's judgment should temper our judgments of others. It should bring us a few notches low. It should cause us to shun pride and self-righteousness as we seek to help other people. That's the issue here. He is reminding us, look, you are also going to face God one day. Look, beloved, everybody, the standard is not different. Someday you're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. This is true for all of us. And that reminder ought to sober us in our approach as we seek to help one another. When we see sin in other people, doesn't it help sometimes to be reminded that you're not perfect either and that someday God will call you to account for your own sins and faults? That changes the way that I approach my brother. The easiest way, you could say, to silence the mouth of any self-righteous and hypocritical accuser or fault finder is to remind them that they too shall come under God's judgment. And think about this. This says nothing about the sin of your brother. It doesn't excuse it either, right? This reminder doesn't excuse the shortcomings of others. In fact, if anything, in the following illustration, Jesus acknowledges that there is still a problem to be addressed and something that your brother needs removed. But by reminding ourselves that God will one day bring us to judgment as well, Jesus says, immediately causes us to be more understanding, to be more compassionate upon the faults of others. And that is exactly what Jesus is doing here. John Stott writes, he reminds us here, we need to be as critical of ourselves as we often are of others and as generous to others as we always are to ourselves. Then we shall anticipate the golden rule to which Jesus brings us in verse 12, and act towards others as we would like to act, or we would like them to act towards us. That's exactly right. That's exactly the context. The problem is not that making moral judgments is always wrong. The problem that Jesus is addressing here in this idea of judging is the problem of holding others to a standard that you do not hold to yourself. That becomes a real issue. The parallel picture, notice in verse 2, being painted with the language of measuring and measurement is probably borrowed from the marketplace. Think about it. You go into the marketplace and you watch somebody weigh out grain with one measurement and then pull out a completely different standard to weigh for himself, right? That's the picture here. It imagines a scenario where someone uses one set of measurements for one person and then a different set of measurements for themselves that results in some kind of personal advantage. And so McLaren says, we look to our neighbor's errors with a microscope and at our own through the wrong end of a telescope. We see neither in their real magnitude. We have two sets of weights and measures, one for home use, the other for foreign, Every vice, and this is so good, has two names, and we call it by its flattering and minimizing one when we commit it, and its ugly one when our neighbor does. Isn't that true? You guys find this to be true in your own hearts? I mean, it is so easy. It is so natural to us, isn't it, to minimize our own sins, to call anger, annoyance, or frustration when we're irritated. I'm just irritated. But you blew up on me. In this command to judge not, Jesus is not asking us to be blind to the sin of others. Rather, he is asking us to see our own sins more clearly. That's the issue. The issue here is that of hypocritical judgment. The warning is against a proud and self-righteous approach to relationships that is far more critical of others than it is of oneself. That's quick to magnify the blame of others while conveniently minimizing one's own guilt. You see, that is always a sure sign of self of someone who is self-righteous. And one more writer, just listen to this quote. He says, the hypocrite here is not only someone who performs deeds of righteousness out of a desire for self-aggrandizement. He's also consumed with pride and self-deception. He's blind to his own sin, but keenly aware of the faults of others. He is devoted to introspection or inspection without introspection, careful examination of others without any sincere evaluation of himself. The fact that this is what Jesus is really speaking against in this prohibition is only confirmed by the following illustration that he gives in the rest of the passage. Notice then, that's the prohibition. Notice the two questions that come. The two questions that come in the illustration here, verses 3 and 4. Jesus now paints an absurd picture. And he asks his disciples, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? What's the illustration here? What's the point? What is the speck and what is the log? Well, one commentator says, a speck was a tiny piece of straw, chaff, or wood. The word was often used to denote that something was small and insignificant. It's fascinating. The word log refers to a piece of heavy timber, such as a beam used in roof construction or to bar a door. So don't picture 2x4. That's too small. Actually, he goes on to say Josephus used the term to describe a huge beam of wood as long and thick as the mast of a ship that was used by Vespasian for a battering ram. The massive beam was armed with a huge piece of iron on the front that had been cast in the shape of a ram's head. Battering ram was so heavy and powerful that even one blow from it caused the mighty walls of Jerusalem to shake. That's what you should picture. And so it's a bit of an exaggeration. It's kind of absurd to, and that thing won't even fit in your eye. But that's the picture. And notice the first question here in verse 3. The first question highlights the absurdity then of fixating and focusing on the minor sins of others while at the same time completely missing or not noticing our own major sins. I mean, that's the issue here that Jesus is getting after. This is what we would call a double standard. And it's absurd for a couple of obvious reasons, right? First, it's amazing that we would even notice something as small and minute as the speck, or really think of it as a piece of sawdust in our brother's eye, right? Especially when there's something as large as this mast sticking out of our eye, obscuring our moral vision, right? And secondly, this is absurd because the word for notice here in reference to the log in our own eye is a word that speaks of intense consideration, contemplation, scrutiny, and even close observation. It's what you might expect that we would have to do in order to see the speck in our brother's eye. And yet, Jesus says, you don't even do that with this gaping thing sticking out of your head. I mean, for those of you who wear contacts or whatever, or even if you don't, you probably, maybe at times you've gotten something small in your eye before and just majorly bothered you. And it's just, and even that little thing, and Jesus is saying, look, this huge thing doesn't even bother you to the point where you haven't considered it. You haven't even carefully examined it. I mean, we would carefully examine our eye to get whatever small thing in there is irritating us. And yet, that is the absurd thing about this picture and illustration. Here you are nitpicking at this speck in your brother's eye. You don't even notice what ought to be not just a major irritation to you, but a serious inconvenience. Hypocritical, self-righteous judgment is always the issue here. It's straining at a gnat when it comes to other people. But when something serious in your own life calls for self-examination, you ignore it and overlook it. This is the problem here. This is the absurdity behind this first question. Listen to some great quotes here by Sinclair Ferguson. He says, Sensitive to sin in others, he has been desensitized to the sin in his own heart. That spirit often begins as a defense mechanism. Isn't this true? We are sensitive to our own failure, but when challenged about it, we pounce on the sin of others. You guys ever do that? To just deflect, right? Soon that guilty sensitivity becomes a habit and then a way of life. He goes on to say, to have strong feelings about the sins of others that are not matched by a ruthless dealing with our own sins is hypocrisy. Guys, take that to heart. I mean, I've met lots of people who seem very zealous about the truth and get after it with other people. But when you dive into their own personal life, you realize that is hypocrisy. That's self-righteousness. Not because they are zealous about the truth, but because what is absent is a ruthless dealing with their own sins in their own life. Guys, make sure you're harder on yourself than you are on other people. I mean, that is not a comment. That's not to say that you shouldn't seek to help others with what you see in their lives. That is more a comment to say, be honest about your own heart. Be brutal about your own sins first. It's easy to imagine that the sins of others are always more heinous than our own and to treat them as such. But Paul warns us, doesn't he? Romans chapter 12, verse 3, for through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. Ask yourself this morning, am I harder on the sins of others than I am on myself, or is it the other way around? How often do you think about what you struggle with, and how often does that temper the way in which you might seek to help somebody else? This is the issue that Jesus is getting at. Because children of God, true kingdom citizens, are going to see themselves rightly. And that is what makes them useful. And that is what gives them clarity. And we just need to clarify real quick the misunderstanding that sometimes occurs here at this point. Sometimes we read this, tell me if maybe some of you have done this or unintentionally thought this way, but sometimes we read this as if the speck and the log are the exact same sin. But that may not necessarily be the case. Jesus doesn't really say that here, even though sometimes that's what we assume of this passage. So what does that lead to? We imagine this means that if we have somehow committed the same sin before, that we're seeing in another brother, that we can't we can't help them or address it, or that we've somehow disqualified ourselves from, we have to somehow find somebody who's never committed that sin before, and that's the guy who can help. It's not a helpful way. It's not really even what Jesus is saying here. While it may be true sometimes that your own struggles might disqualify you if they're similar because you haven't gotten a hold of them yet, but here's, I think Jesus is more saying here that the issue is not that the speck and the log are the same sin, though they may very well be at times, but it's not necessarily what makes you unfit to help your brother. All that Jesus really says here is that one is far more serious of a problem than the other one is. So the issue is whether you've rightly seen and dealt with your own sin before trying to help your brother, whether it's the same issue or not. The issue is whether you've considered and examined yourself before the Lord first, before attempting to help somebody else. Just think about it. There are circumstances, right? Situations in which God's providence has it so that actually you are most qualified to help another person with their sin because you have struggled with that in the past. And so the issue is not so much the kind of sin that it's the same sin. The issue is how have you dealt with the sin that you do see in your life? And that brings us to the second question in verse 4 that, notice, highlights the absurdity of assuming that you can successfully then do this eye surgery on somebody else while you have this mask sticking out of your face. Nobody would go to that eye doctor, right? David Turner says, "Ignorance of oneself is often mixed with arrogance towards others. It inevitably leads there." I mean, this verse gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, the blind leading the blind. It's often when we fail to judge ourselves rightly that we arrogantly assume, isn't it, that we are better than others, and then we seek to have an influence over them. So people like this, sometimes their offer to help you is not a genuine offer. It's a way to rub it in your face that they know or better, or that they're not struggling with that. As John Stott points out, this apparent act of kindness is made the means of inflating our own ego. Behind this insincere offer of help to remove your brother's speck is a sinister motive of self-exaltation. And this is why Jesus calls this hypocrisy. Because it's not what it appears to be on the surface. Right? It's not a genuine, I want to help you because I love you. And the language here in the comment to your brother, notice in verse 4, the language here is a command. Let me, or allow me, that's a command. Allow me to take the speck out of your eye. It's an insistence. This is somebody who is insisting on being the instrument that God uses to remove their brother's speck, to solve their brother's problem. And as we've already seen, the motive is not out of love. The motive is their own significance. It is amazing here, isn't it? As I said earlier, that we can sometimes seek our own significance even in an act of ministry. Well, this happens all the time. It's a particular temptation for us, perhaps. You think Paul, there's a reason why Paul, you remember, was given a thorn in his flesh. The text says to keep him from exalting himself because God had so determined to use him. I mean, Paul was so useful to the early church. God had to humble him in a major way to keep him from exalting himself. Just real quick, if you have, just flip over to 1 Corinthians 4. I know I've talked about this passage before, but Paul reminds us there, such a helpful text. I mean, the problem, this was a problem in Corinth, wasn't it? They were comparing ministry giftedness, saying, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos. There are factions. Paul calls it pride and arrogance. And he reminds them in 1 Corinthians 4, notice beginning in verse 1, he says, here's how you should think of yourselves. Let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me, it's a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. There's the root of those words for examine is our word for judgment here. Notice verse 4, for I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. Therefore, verse 5, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. What was the issue? Look at verse 6. Now these things, brethren, I figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against another. And some great reminders in verse 7. For who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? You see, Paul is so very much aware of this, that even in ministry, we can minister to others, we can compare ourselves with one another for our own significance out of pride, self-righteousness, and arrogance. And he says, don't do that. This is Jesus's point here. The man who looks at his brother and says, let me help you with that, and all the while turns a blind eye to his own severe sins, is guilty of this. It betrays a heart motive that is seeking his own glory and not God's glory. If he sought God's glory, he'd deal with his own sin. So we have to see ourselves rightly if we want to be used of God. Humility is what puts you in God's hand as a useful instrument. Pride will cause him to cast you down. That is always true. That is what the Bible teaches. So Jesus finally gives us the solution back to Matthew chapter 7. Verse 5, notice, and we talked about it earlier. Jesus gives us the solution after his illustration. Notice verse 5, he says, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Look, in the end, Jesus says that you are still called to take the speck out of your brother's eye. That ought to still be your goal. Only you are to do so after you have removed the log from your own eye. That's how we know this is the problem. That's how we know that hypocrisy and self-righteousness is the issue and not just merely making moral judgments. The solution to the problem of self-righteousness and hypocrisy is not to just become an undiscerning, tolerant blob, right? Rather, the solution is greater clarity and greater integrity in your own personal life. This last verse makes it clear that the point is not to discourage moral judgment when it comes to the sins of others. Rather, what's being condemned here is the sin of self-righteous hypocrisy that makes you unfit to judge with any kind of clarity. Paul reminds us of this principle also. You can just listen. You can write down for further study Galatians 6, verses 1 through 3. Such a helpful passage. Maybe I'll teach it in here after the Sermon on the Mount, just a short series on how to help other people, how to minister to other people. But I love that passage, Galatians 6, 1 through 3. The same principle, notice, of looking to ourselves before we imagine we can help others. Paul says, brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, You who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one, listen, looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. That's the issue. So hopefully you see now that the problem here was a self-righteousness that ignored this our own sins and sought to exalt ourselves over others, imagining that we could help them with their sins. That's the issue that Jesus is condemning here. And so that's helpful in how we relate to one another as kingdom citizens. That's the first piece of his instructions on ministry relationships, earthly relationships, and we'll look at the next few in the coming weeks. So let's pray together. Father, thanks for this reminder. We are so prone to exalt ourselves over one another and even to use ministry to do so. Forgive us. Father, may we always simply see others in the light of your evaluation. May we view ourselves rightly as all being under the scrutiny of your word and accountable to the same standard. Lord, help us to be humble, to look first, to deal swiftly and ruthlessly with our own faults and failures before we turn to seek to help others. Help us even in this group to do so effectively so that we can disciple and be discipled. Lord, prepare us for this next hour. Make our minds sharp to receive your word once again. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right. So much for ending early.